when we find that true disenchantment has arisen towards all that the world has to offer, it means that equanimity has arisen. Because no longer do we find anything revolting then as a next step, nor do we find anything specifically attractive. It all just is, as it is. And that step is the significant one which brings us from the disenchantment to dispassion. Dispassion in Pali is viraga. Passion is raga. And from it comes the English rage. Not particularly rage as anger, but rage as raging, being where the action is. So viraga is the end of that raging inside. And it is the opposite, which is equanimity. And so what we see around us, what we confront, what happens around, inside, it just is. And it no longer has the aspect of being obnoxious, nor does it have the aspect of being specifically enticing. So the mind is not in any way either pulled towards or pulled away from it. And it becomes what is so often called spacious. That is the first moment it does become that. Namely, it has room in it, space in it, energy in it to do the next step. Because that, what we are busy with in our ordinary lives, no longer has any sting to it. Having seen quite clearly that all that exists has aspects of dukkha, because it has, in the first place, the materiality, the body, which decays, and it has the mind, which is constantly trying to know, understand, be in charge of, get involved with, which is called the impinging and signifying qualities. The impinging is that which touches upon us, and signifying that which gives the signals. Having seen all that as being constantly a source of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, and being equanimous towards all around us, the mind now takes an interest in finding something which will be totally fulfilling, and no longer an interest in finding that fulfillment in the world. It's quite clear to such a mind, having gone through all the stages of insight and having come to that even-mindedness towards all these things in the world, that it has to be something which does not depend upon conditions. Body depends upon the condition of craving, of wanting to be here. That's how it got born, and that's how it remains until it breaks up into bits and pieces again. And the condition of mind is contacting otherwise it doesn't arise. So it wants to find something which doesn't have the quality of this unsatisfactoriness, doesn't want to have, wants to find something which has to be based on unconditioned, on the unconditioned, because it has seen, the mind has seen, that everything that has conditions and causes will never be satisfying. Naturally, the mind doesn't know what the unconditioned is like, but it is already strong and clear enough to be able to realize that it has to turn away from that what it is usually concerned with. And usually it is concerned with something that arises, which is called an occurrence. There's always something that arises, and it has been clearly seen by now that all that which is occurring has the three characteristics. It has the characteristic of impermanence, has the characteristic of non-satisfactoriness, and of corelessness, substancelessness. Having seen that the body and the mind are depending upon conditions and have no reality in themselves, has already shown that the ego idea is an illusion, but it still hasn't seen something else, the mind. So it is trying to turn away from all that's occurring to something which will give total satisfaction. The mind then can understand, if it is already strong and clear enough, and by that time it should be, that there has to be a still point, a point where nothing occurs. And when it has seen that this is necessary to find that, because that which is still does not have a condition because it isn't arising nor ceasing, and this is what the mind is searching for. It realizes also that there is to be made a step forward. And this step has an analogy which is described in the Visuddhimagga like this. And it's a description which will, I think, make it quite clear. It's a good analogy. It is as if one wants to get from one bank of the river to the other side. And the momentum of practice is that which makes it possible to have the energy to do that. So, one ties the rope of materiality to the branch of selfhood and takes that rope with the momentum of practice to get such a swing. And as one swings across the river on that rope, one can see the other side, one tends and inclines towards the other bank and can let go of the rope, which is all that is materiality and the branch of selfhood, and falls down on the other bank. Which means one has at that moment been able to let go of hanging on to anything that is in existence, particularly, of course, this body, and has been able to let go of the notion that there is somebody inside this body who is me. And having been able to let go completely, one can fall down on that other side, on the other bank, Naturally, when one falls down there, one staggers. One is not secure and safe yet, but has to find one's footing. This is an analogy for the path moment, magga. Magga means path. That's what it means. But the word magga is used for the moment of entering the path, where what we call occurs the change of lineage. The change of lineage means that up to then one has been a putujana, which is a worldling. And at that moment, one comes into the lineage of the Aryans, which are the noble ones, the lineage of those who gained enlightenment according to the Buddha's teaching. And this is the first instance when this happens, which is called stream entry, sotapanna. Now this is a path moment, which of course does not occur like this. This is the analogy for it. But it is a moment of jhanic absorption, but just one single moment. That's all it is. A single moment of jhanic absorption where there is no occurrence. That means nothing arises and therefore nothing ceases in that moment. And although the past moment is only one moment and does not have the actual recognition in it, the next moment, which is called the liberation, vimutti, is the fruit moment. And that is two moments. And that fruit moment gives a recognition of what has happened. In that fruit moment, one has the fruit of that which has happened. Now that is the recognition, the understood experience. And it is a fact that there are people in the world today who have had such past moments without practice and without instruction, and had no idea what happened to them. And 20 or even many more years later, find out what happened to them. Because if they don't know what happened to them, it has, although it changes their attitude to the world, it does not have the great benefit that it should have. This particular instance is an experience of non-occurrence. And non-occurrence means having experienced the unconditioned. The unconditioned, which is a word which is bandied about a lot and hardly understood, can be understood in this way. It is a return to the ground of being, to the matrix of existence, where within that unconditioned state, all conditions can arise through craving. But since for a person who has done that step, the craving has abated, the unconditioned remains one of the aspects of that person's consciousness. The actual benefit arises in the next two moments, which are called phala, P-H-A-L-A, which is fruit. So this is always called in Pali magga phala. The PH is just pronounced P. Magga phala is path and fruit. And that fruit moment, in that moment, is a realization of what one has experienced. A moment in which the self-notion was obliterated. It was obliterated to the point where, in the fruit moment, an enormous sense of relief is experienced, as if one has let go of carrying around an enormous burden. That relief is also combined with the understanding, because of having practiced, of what has occurred. What has occurred, namely the consciousness having turned away from all that we know, whether it is beautiful, wholesome, acceptable, or the opposite, makes no difference. Because all that we know has within it the notion, I know. No matter how wonderful it is that one knows. And what has occurred is a moment of no, I know, but an experience where within that experience is nothing but the matrix, the ground of being. Having come back from that, comes an interesting aspect. It is either immediate, it can take place later. In many cases, it takes place later. It's called reviewing knowledge. It takes place later because this particular experience has great impact. And that impact has to be digested first. So one sort of, as if one has had a very long and strenuous journey, one has to sit down and rest from that first. This has been a long and strenuous journey through many lifetimes, maybe thousands of them. A long and strenuous journey with lots of dukkha. And here, at that moment, with the impetus of practice and the ability to completely let go of all that connects us to the conditioned state, has come the first ability to realize finality. It is only the first step. And in this tradition, there are four steps, three until the final step is made. But this very first one is so significant because of its enormous impact on the psyche. The impact is one where what we call the first three fetters are removed. Traditionally, we talk about 10 fetters which bind us to the conditioned state. And the first three are lost at this time. And the most significant one is that we will never again believe ourselves to be an entity, an identity, a personality. Now, the stress of the sentence is on the word believe, because the stream enterer is not yet able to have that as a constant inner feeling and constantly be in that state. But he will never again, he or she, will never again believe him or herself to be a person with personal identity, with solidity, compactness, and with something of a core inside. The wrong view of self is lost. But this is, for the stream enterer, a viewpoint, not a steady experience. This is, so to say, the kindergarten of enlightenment. It's a first step in. The second fetter which is lost is the belief in rites and rituals. That doesn't mean that one cannot perform them. One can if one wishes. But the belief that they will bring enlightenment is lost because one has seen that something entirely different has brought this state about. The constant letting go. The constant letting go of the attraction and the repulsion, which gets back to reacting to feelings, but it goes much further in this case. This constant attraction and repulsion has given way to equanimity and to seeing the uselessness of trying to find satisfaction here, and has then resulted in the ability to completely let go of the personality illusion and of the personal expectance of finding that peace, that harmony for that one person. That has all been let go of. No rite, no ritual can do that for one. And the third fetter, which is lost, is skeptical doubt. These two are lost for the duration. Duration meaning until this body breaks up. Skeptical doubt and belief in rites and rituals is lost for the duration. The wrong view of self is also lost, but it has not given way yet to the ability to be with that constantly. Skeptical doubt is lost because one has proven the Buddha's words for oneself. There's nothing to doubt. One knows this is so. This is so that consciousness carries within either samsara or nibbana. And that it's possible for a human being to have a consciousness which carries liberation within. There's no possibility of having any skeptical doubt. Traditionally, it is said that such a person has maximum 7 more lives as a human being as until becoming fully enlightened. However, all this can take place in the same lifetime. Traditionally, it is said, such a person can never be born again below a human being. The next 7 lifetimes are taking place in the human realm. Can never take any other teacher except the Buddha, because the Buddha has given the instruction for this resultant, and can never break again any of the 5 precepts. The resultants are due to the cause of losing the first 3 fetters. But as you can see, greed and hate haven't been touched yet. But wrong view of self has been touched. And wrong view of self is a root cause for greed and hate. So greed and hate are diminished. They are not quite the same burden they used to be. It's not quite as heavy anymore. but they aren't by any means eliminated. It takes as far as a non-returner to eliminate them. So you can see from that description alone that a puttajana, a worldling, is beset. All puttajanas, all worldlings are beset by hate and greed. And although they are unpleasant, it's no use blaming oneself or others for them. This is the natural way human beings are. To become a stream enterer is transcending the natural humanness and could go into the super mundane level. It's a transcendent level. We're transcending the human level. Once the Buddha was sitting under a tree and a wanderer came by and admired him, admired his very shining appearance and asked him, "Are you a god?" And the Buddha said, "No." And he said, "Are you a man?" And the Buddha said, "No." And so the wanderer said, "Well, what are you then, if you're neither god nor man?" And he said, "I'm the Buddha, enlightened. It's neither god nor man." Naturally, as we all know, the Buddha started out as a man, just as a human being, as we are. But when we reach the level of the Noble Ones, it has a transcendental quality. It has the quality of no longer having to deal with the human level on the same level that we have dealt with it until then. Although the stream enterer, as I said, still has 7 fetters left, of which 2 are greed and hate. And yet he has already gained his foothold in the Aryan path. He's gained his foothold on reaching a total liberation. This passion, not being attracted or repulsed, means that we can live in the world quite easily. It is no longer the difficulty that we used to have when we were dividing the spiritual quality from the non-spiritual qualities. And because we no longer divide, we are able to make this enormous step, because there's no division in the mind. That step means one thing only. It means having let go of all craving. At that moment, some of that craving returns for the stream enterer. But having let go of all craving at that moment means that we no longer have the wish to be here. We also do not have the wish to be otherwise. There is nothing that is attracting or repulsing, nothing that keeps us here or otherwise. This letting go of craving means primarily letting go of the notion of selfhood. And that is what anatta, non-self, that is what corelessness, substancelessness, and void means. Letting go of the notion of selfhood. It doesn't mean not to have thoughts. It doesn't mean not to be able to function in the world. It doesn't mean that a stream enterer looks, acts, talks, or doth anything particularly different from what he used to do before, it just means that the viewpoint from which he regards it all has changed completely. It's not just an on and off affair of remembering impermanence or of remembering any bit of the teaching, but the viewpoint has changed totally. This is a realm which needs to be transcended, and a realm in which all beings live with the delusion which makes them unhappy. And that viewpoint brings a great deal of compassion. And that was the reason why the Buddha taught for 45 years, his compassion for the beings who are roaming around in samsara without any help to get out. The fruit moment can be resurrected at any time that the person who has experienced it wishes. It means that this fruit moment then becomes part of that person's experience because one resurrects it, and as it is being resurrected, it provides the ultimate peacefulness. In that ultimate peacefulness, there is nobody there. That ultimate peacefulness goes beyond existence. There's no craving to be. There's also no craving not to be. There is nobody there that wants to be. There's nobody there that doesn't want to be. It goes back into the ground of being. The fruit moment can be resurrected. The past moment only occurs once for each of the different stages of enlightenment. So it needs continual practice to be able to go to the next step. The next step is called the once returner. And the once returner, as the word says, comes back once more in order to finish off what he didn't finish this time. The once returner doesn't lose any of the fetters. He just gets hate and greed somewhat abated. It gets less, but it still isn't eliminated. It is a second path experience. Having had the first one, naturally it's much easier to go to the second one. Having once been concentrated, for instance, and entering first jhana, there's no problem to do that again. And the same applies here. Having been able to take this enormous jump across the river for the first time, it is not quite as difficult to do it a second time. The mind needs to have that particular determination, and it has it quite naturally, because a stream winner, a stream enterer, still experiences dukkha. He's certainly not got out of dukkha yet. And knowing that there is something that makes it possible to be out of dukkha gives him, of course, enormous impetus to go further. Having experienced it once, to have been out of dukkha for that particular moment and any other moment that he wishes to return to it, he can have that very strong determination to go further. So a Sri Mantra would never stop practicing and would know that it is necessary to turn the mind, the consciousness, away from worldly affairs. Because worldly affairs, although there is no attraction to them, they are still a disturbance. So it is often the case that someone who has been able to get to that path moment wants to practice in solitude or at least in a place which is removed from worldly affairs. The worldly affairs are so much a distraction and have so much strength in them that it is difficult to be able to turn oneself entirely away. It's only the Arahant who has completed the task, to whom worldly affairs have absolutely no sting anymore. That mind can never be shaken again, but the Sri Mantra certainly can still be shaken. So such a person tries to turn himself away from these, from too many worldly affairs, and just be concerned with the absolute necessities, and tries to re-arouse the path moment through the concentration in the meditation and through the turning away from the consciousness, turning the consciousness away from that which has occurrences in it, because he realizes that that's what he did the first time. So the consciousness needs the still point, and as one does it more often, one becomes practiced in it. That the consciousness has actually a still point where there's no movement, that this is possible to experience, and with that still point in the consciousness, to let go again, to go beyond existence. This letting go and going beyond existence is hard to put into a terminology which is easily understandable, because one isn't going anywhere. One's right where one always has been. But it is the aspect of letting go of this appearance that we are making here in this world, our appearance here as being something which is desirable, valuable, and should be continued. If you can think of that for a moment, you will realize that this goes against an ordinary person's grain. Greg's nodding. And therefore it needs all that practice which has gone on before to come to that point, because it must also not have any revulsion in it, because the revulsion for that what goes on here is just the other side of the same coin of attraction. So it's a complete letting go and understanding or realizing that which is unconditioned is the only situation, the only experience which can have in it no dukkha whatsoever. So when the second step is taken, the person becomes a once returner, and it is up to the person, him or herself, to make that judgment what they have done. They can, of course, explain it to a teacher who has a knowledge, and not only a knowledge, an experience of this, But it is still up to the person to make that realization. Having done this, and wanting to resurrect the fruit moment, then the person resurrects the fruit moment by being determined to have the fruit moment of the second path. And having that determination and gaining that fruit moment of the second path gives the confirmation that that was what one actually experienced. Is that clear? Shall I say that again? No, I thought so. Having experienced the second path moment, of course there's also a fruit moment for the second path. Again, there's that same two moments after the path moment in which the person realizes what has happened. And that realization again brings about relief and release, ease and a feeling of having shed more of a burden. And these fruit moments can be resurrected at will. And a person who has had second path will then have determination to resurrect second path fruit moment. And re-establishing that gives the confirmation that that is what has happened. Is that any better? Okay.
The highest gesture to say that it happened to me.
At the time of the path moment, there is only possible to have the path moment when the total letting go has happened. However, the notion of self is only totally eliminated for the Arahant. It is consecutively lessened and lessened. The viewpoint has totally changed. The viewpoint is one which is entirely opposite to the ordinary viewpoint. The ordinary viewpoint is, this is me, and I want to become enlightened. Such a viewpoint is no longer possible. However, the total experience of that is not constantly with the person of the first and second path, because it is not the totality of the experience yet. The viewpoint is that everything is exactly as it has always been, and it's all right the way it is. But within all this which has always been, there is nothing that has any real significance. That is called the signless liberation, which happens to the person who investigates impermanence as the overriding subject. The wishless liberation happens for the person who uses dukkha as the overriding subject, because it is seen at that time, of course, that dukkha can no longer arise when there are no wishes. And the void liberation arises for the one who takes anatta as the main subject. So the viewpoint has changed for both of these path people, stream enterer and one-sojourner, but there are still seven fetters to be lost. And the next path is called the non-returner. And the non-returner is a person who will not come back to the human realm, but will finish the work in one of the Brahma realms. The non-returner loses hate and greed. He has now lost 5 fetters, and there are 5 remaining. So the step from non-returner to arahant is a very, very big one, to the total realization. However, these 3 preliminary steps, particularly to be a non-returner, is I can't think of anything else to say except an enormous achievement, although that again sounds as if somebody's achieving something. It is trying to think of a different word. It's an enormous letting go. That's better. It is having seen reality for what it really is and not being anymore fooled by any of these outer appearances. We are constantly fooled by the outer appearances. Everybody looks as if they were a person. Everybody looks as if they were either a man or a woman. Everybody looks like somebody or something, and everybody feels like somebody or something, and everybody wants to be somebody or something. And out there everything looks interesting, sometimes bleak and sometimes wonderful. And all these appearances have fooled us for so many lifetimes. And what they have done to us is they have constantly resurrected the dukkha. They have never given non-fulfillment. One mustn't think of dukkha as only pain, grief and lamentation, although it's that too, of course. But it is unsatisfactoriness and non-fulfillment, and we all know that. And we have known it for ever so long. But when we can practice, and when we can understand how to practice, then we have an enormous chance to get out. But it isn't me that's getting out. It's just getting out. It's just getting out that one of the delusions have disappeared. It's one of those little bubbles that have arisen out of the matrix of existence, no longer thinks of itself as a separate bubble, but just gets back down into this matrix of existence without any resistance and no longer wants to be a separate bubble. So when the non-returner has made the 3rd step, again, the proof of the experience lies in the fact that the resurrection of the fruit moment comes upon the determination that the 3rd path fruit moment should be resurrected, and a non-returner can do that. The resurrection of the fruit moment gives such a person the opportunity and the ability to rest to rest completely within within the unconditioned, within a fold of where nothing is occurring. So with having the opportunity to do this at will, such a person is of course very much shielded from having dukkha, although there are still 5 fetters remaining. And the one fetter which is significant at this time, it's called ignorance, which means nothing else except still not being totally rid of self, is described as the aroma that clings to a flower. So clings the notion of self to the non-returner. It's a very fine aroma. It's still there, and the non-returner knows it. Because one of the things that happen after the fruit moment, and usually quite a while after, but this is individually different, I suppose, is reviewing. Reviewing what has happened. We do that under all circumstances. If we've had some interesting experience, we review it later, what happened. Or if we've had some significant experience, we review it. So here is an impact experience. And so the reviewing comes. And the reviewing reviews the past moment, the fruit moment, the defilements which are no longer arising, and the defilements which are still arising, and the experience of Nibbana. So such a person, this is done sometime after path and fruit, because otherwise one doesn't know what defilements are arising. One hasn't had a chance yet to let them arise. Such a person knows very well what defilements are still there, and also knows which defilements no longer arise. They are, at that time, absolutely and utterly cut off. There's no longer any need to suppress them, to recognize them and substitute. None of this is necessary. They just don't arise. Now, in the first two instances, hate and greed, which are the root cause of all our defilements, are only lessened. In the first instance, only a little bit, and in the second instance, quite a lot. One could say maybe halved, something like that. In a once-returner, one could say more than that. In a once-returner, hate and greed, hate would arise as irritation, but not as hate. And greed would arise as an aspect of liking, but not grabbing for it. The mind likes, but does not go for it. That is in the aspect of the once-returner. In the aspect of the stream-enterer, hate would still arise as anger, but it would be very well aware of it. And greed would still arise as grabbing for it. And yet, such a person would be so aware of it, because the viewpoint has changed so much, that the mindfulness would help him very much to diminish this further, to get to the next step. The non-returner has no hate or greed. The attractions of the world leave him cold, and the unpleasant situations which even the Buddha was confronted with, many of them, have absolutely no repercussion. But there are five fetters still there, and the one I said already is ignorance, where there's notion of self still clings like the aroma. And another one is restlessness, because the self has not totally been eliminated. There's still that restlessness which every worldling knows of going somewhere else, doing something else, getting something else. That restlessness in a very subtle manner is still there. And then something interesting is there, namely a desire to be reborn either in the Deva or in the Brahma realms, which are either the fine material realms or the non-material realms. There's a desire because there's still this little bit of clinging to self. There's this idea, well, at least I could have a very nice next existence in one of those wonderful realms where there's absolutely no dukkha. And the fifth one is called mano, which is conceit. But it doesn't mean that the person is conceited. It means that there is a conceiving still of a selfhood. There's still a conceiving. There are still concepts there. There's a conceptualizing, a conceiving of, which is all due to the fact that there is a selfhood notion still left. These are very subtle differences, but the person who has experienced that knows those fetters in him or herself, has done the reviewing knowledge and the reviewing, and have got the knowledge from that reviewing that these fetters are there. With the ignorance and the conceit, which are actually both one and the same thing, and the restlessness, there is a definite understanding that there's still some me in there. Although the experience has now happened 3 times, there has been a 3 times experience of Nibbana. And the experience of Nibbana cuts out all notion of selfhood at the time. It still re-arises. It's interesting to know that, because it can show everyone how strong that notion of selfhood is embedded in an ordinary person. That even after having had 3 experiences of Nibbana, the notion is still not totally eliminated. The last 5 fetters are only lost with arahantship. The arahant has, therefore, the 4th opportunity for gaining path and fruit. The path moment for each of those steps is only once. So if there have been 4 path moments, the person is then an arahant. That person does no more reviewing, because that person knows that defilements have been eliminated, that there's absolutely nothing arising within which has any kind of dislike, revulsion, repulsion, and there has absolutely nothing within which has any kind of grasping or wanting to have. Nothing of the sort is arising. And that is only possible because such a person has already eliminated the desire for rebirth in those other realms. These 5 fetters are necessary to other work that a non-returner does. He works on those 5 fetters. And having brought them down to the barest minimum, is able to have the last path moment so that they are totally eliminated. We can look at these path moments, although they are all extremely similar, but they become more and more, they become deeper and further reaching, as if one takes an exam at university on one particular subject, and one has a major and takes exams, and in the first year, the exams are by no means as far-reaching as they are in the 2nd year, and in the 3rd year, and the 4th year. They're still on the same subject. They're still on the same major. But they become far more far-reaching. And as these path moments become deeper and more far-reaching, they have this enormously deep impact on the psyche, on the consciousness. The consciousness cannot return to ordinary consciousness for the arahant. That doesn't mean that the arahant doesn't eat, sleep, feel, talk, have conversations about the weather, conversations about whatever happens. It doesn't mean that an arahant doesn't have the ability to be totally ordinary. On the contrary, the arahant would be totally ordinary. The only thing that is completely lost is the notion in the arahant that there's anybody there doing it. These are nothing but five khandhas operating until the khanda of the body is destroyed through death, and therefore the khanda of mind can return to matrix of existence. The ever recurring refrain after anyone had mentioned to the Buddha arahantship was, destroyed is birth, the holy life is lived, what had to be done has been done, there's nothing more to come. And that might be a good ending. There's nothing more to come.